unpack like what was going through your head in terms of the motivation to make things and at that time.
I think it was girls.
Here, here. Welcome to The Marinade, a free-flowing conversation about the creative process with creative people. Each episode, we welcome musicians, actors, comedians, authors, visual artists, filmmakers, anyone who creates art to talk about how and why we make stuff. This is episode 163, and our guest is Jason Hawk Harris. Jason is a singer and songwriter who makes his home in Austin, Texas. His latest record, Thin Places, is an examination of grief in a way that speaks so directly to my own recent experiences. He is classically trained and full of creative energy and just a fucking sweetheart on top of that. Jason Hawk Harris is the ideal Marinade thought partner, and I'm so grateful to bring y'all my conversation with him.
Poured the ashes from the river's edge, they shone golden in the riverbed. Yeah, they lingered for a couple days till a storm came and brushed them away. Now every time I'm by a river bank, I look to see if there's a golden wake. Guess I'm looking for that healing tide, where one day the Jordan gonna swallow the Nile. One day the Jordan gonna swallow the Nile.
Dude, I've been sitting in the wrong Zoom room for 25 minutes. I was like, no way I'm missing it this time. No way. No way that's going to happen. And then, I'm so sorry.
It's so funny.
I don't even know what to say at this point. It's just like.
It's just how it all worked out. And it worked out the way it's supposed to work out.
So
you
I've
know?
Got. Yeah, and I've got your in my Google Calendar. I have my work stuff and my personal stuff in there, and
Yeah.
I just clicked the wrong event and went into the wrong Zoom room. And
Just
like
chilling.
I was gonna let you be as late as you wanted, and then I was like, okay, it's been like 25 minutes, and I was doing another task waiting, and so then I was just like, wait, is this the right room? I couldn't,
Dude.
of course. And then I saw your email and was like, damn it.
I fucking love that. I love the whole, I love it all worked out this way. Thank you for doing this, man. This is exciting.
Yeah.
I've been looking forward to this for a while. Like, I'm so glad we connected. We've kind of connected, I guess, for a while on Twitter. I feel like we've
Yeah, I
sort of.
mean, man, I feel like in this business, I meet most of the people I know through Twitter, honestly.
That's the beauty. I and that's, you know, when everybody started complaining about Elon, as they should, and I understand, and everybody's like, I'm going elsewhere. I was like, you motherfuckers are gonna be back. It's so good
Yeah,
here,
man.
you
And
know?
they're already starting to come back. Like I've already seen people come back. And like, I don't like that Elon owns Twitter any more than anybody else. But the fact of the matter is that there's just a culture there that doesn't exist on the other like text platforms.
And people complain understandably about the Nazis. Listen, not Nazi fans here, neither of us,
No,
right?
not at all.
Like, let's make sure we're on record
Yeah.
as if we needed to be. But I don't see a lot of fucking Nazis, dude. I see you. I see Van Plating. I see, like, I see I think Roger Harvey's still on there. I don't know. Like, I see Zach Schultz, super fan Zach, who's a good friend up in Minneapolis area. I see all these wonderful people sharing music and art, and I don't get a lot of Nazis. So maybe I point to everyone and say, where are these Nazis coming from?
I think that it's another example in this world we live in of the loudest people in the room being the ones that kind of affect like how we view things, you know?
Yeah.
And like, 'cause I think a lot of people reacted to Elon owning Twitter as like, okay, well that totally sucks. It's like my favorite place on the internet. That blows really bad. But yeah, I can agree with you that I haven't had many Nazis. The only thing that sometimes if I post about, you know, if I like accidentally post a buzzword in there, and I try really hard not to, you know, one of those words that people are just searching for on the internet, to troll. Like every now and then I'll get the only thing annoying about Elon's Twitter is all the sex bots. That's the main thing. It's like, I've had so many more sex bots.
True.
Than before he owned it, but yeah.
True. And I don't know what this says about me or the world or whatever, but the period of time where my wife left me and I was single for a little while, the sex bots seemed to be coming at me even harder. And I was like, what am I searching? What am I interacting with that's causing this? Is this just in my head?
You ever like tweet about your divorce or anything?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm sure that was it. They just like, they pegged you, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, they were offering to, and you know, respectfully declined.
Yeah, that was. I wish that pun was intended.
Dude, well, I do want to talk about art as well.
I like not that stuff.
Yeah, not that pegging isn't art, but I do want to talk about your record, Thin Places, and
yeah,
man, because I think. You know, there's so many records that came out last year that I was obsessed with. And I think when yours came out, there was so much. That's one of the challenges, I think, in general, making stuff. It's true for me, podcasting or writing. It's true for you, making records. It's true for all of us that there's just so much and getting it out. And so when I listened to it the first time, I was like, this is really good. I got to spend some time with it because there's so much. And then I got buried in a mountain of other things. And then finally I came back to it in a huge way when you and I really connected and decided to do this. So like I had listened to it quite a bit before, but then I just like immersed myself, right?
Yeah.
And
that's awesome, man. Thank you.
Thanks. You're truly my pleasure. And thank you for making this beautiful record, because that's it. When it first hit me, when you and I first connected, I was going through it, man. Like, yeah. I was at the darkest place I've ever been.
Yeah.
And I love sad music. I love music that deals with grief. I love that. I'm a sucker for these things. People listening know this. It's clear in the choices that I make for records that I buy and things I listen to and the art I consume. But rarely has a record hit me in a way, or any piece of art, honestly, Jason, has hit me in a way that allowed me to appreciate and process at the same time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great. I can't think of a better reaction to my record, honestly.
And I wonder how much when you're writing a record like this, especially one that's so personal, how much are you aware in the moment of writing how it's going to hit once it's done, hit other people?
Not at all. Yeah. I mean, I stopped trying to write music that people would respond to. But I just, at some point I stopped writing music that people would respond to and just started writing music that I responded to. And I think that, I wanted to like it more than anybody. You know, like I wanted it to be my thing. And I feel like that's the most, you know, for me, that's the most honest way that I can make music, is by being true to myself and, you know, musically and, you know, lyrically. And I think that, I think I used to try to write stuff that was really catchy so that people would really like it, or like that people would respond to, or that people would really like. But the irony is that when I started to write music in this new way, people responded more. People responded more than ever. I think it's because I was just like, you know, if you connect with yourself on a human level, you're going to connect with other humans, and you're the human that you know best. So like, what better character to dive deep into than yourself, you know, to make some art. And I think that people relate to that, you know, even if it's situations that they don't, you know, even if they don't share the exact things that I'm going through. But I don't know, does that make sense?
It makes a ton of sense. When was that moment? Like when did you sort of like recognize I'm gonna go in this new direction?
Yeah. So I wrote, like, I had like 3 or 4 albums in high school that I wrote and recorded and came out with, like, locally, you know. I'd say that during that time in my life, when I was in high school and early college, I was definitely trying to, like, make music that I thought people would really like, you know? And it ended up sounding kind of stilted, like ultimately. And I couldn't see it then, but I can see it now. Yeah, I just kind of had a moment where I was like, I think I released a song and was just like, people aren't responding to this at all. Like not one bit. I listened back to the song now and I totally understand why. But now I was listening then and thinking like, this is, I like this. Like I this is good, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think there were two things going on there. I think one is that I didn't know about publicists or labels or anything. I was literally just making music and posting it on the internet and hoping it would go viral like a high schooler would, you know? And it just, you know, and when it didn't, I made a ultimately helpful, but wrong judgment that it was because people didn't like it. But I think it was mostly because like I couldn't, you know, but it ended up being helpful because I ended up starting to write music just for myself and you know, and in turn, write it for other people by writing it for myself.
Okay. I want to, if I can, dive a little bit deeper into that, because I think whether like as a young person making that music, you're also a young creative regardless. Like we all have sort of that, you know, there are lots of folks who start a little bit later. You're making it pretty at a pretty young age, but still that's that nascent kind of moment in the creative process.
Yeah.
Can you kind of get to that headspace for a second and sort of unpack like what was going through your head in terms of the motivation to make things and at that time?
I think it was girls.
Here.
I think that, I mean, I truly loved writing music.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of, it was like a compulsion. Like I got horrible grades in school because I was just always writing music. And it was a compulsion for me. But I think I was largely motivated by, you know, I like, what's a non-gross way to say this? Just getting women.
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah. I mean, that's why I've talked about this before, but it's been a while since I've talked about it. That's why I was so focused on sports. I still love sports, and I loved sports then. And I'm fairly athletic, and I was, especially 20 years ago.
But it serves a different purpose now than it did.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think when I look back, because none of the guys that were getting the girls were picking up guitars or a trumpet or whatever back in my little town in Central Florida, you know, it was the athletes that were. And so, and then in college, it changed a little bit, but still, you know, the fact that I was a little more testosterone driven to hit a stereotype served me well in that pursuit.
Yeah.
And then later I look back and I go like, well, wait a minute. I have this lifelong thing I could have had in terms of nurturing the creative and musical side.
Right.
And so I completely relate to that. And I don't, yeah, I completely relate to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, and I bet you love it in some ways. I bet you love it more now than you did.
Which
sport
part?
Sports in general.
I just recently, I'm so glad you asked. I'm back into sports card collecting. Like
nice.
I just the other day at a silent auction won a box of football cards and a box of baseball cards. And the baseball cards are the 1991 Topps complete set. And whoever had it before, and I'm a Reds fan. So the Reds won the World Series in 1990. So the last year on that is 1990, the last year stats.
Uh-huh.
So they're all bundled together by team.
Amazing.
And the first bundle I pulled was the Reds.
That's amazing.
Isn't that
I
great?
Love that. That
yes.
Did they win the World Series in 1990?
Yeah.
Is that the one where they were going against Dusty Baker?
In 90, no. They played the A's, and the A's were like a juggernaut. That's Canseco, McGuire, Dave Stewart, right? Eckersley.
I remember this. They went to the World Series three times in a row, and they won it when the earthquake happened, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and then
and the Reds, you. The Reds swept them.
Oh my gosh, that's
the A's were heavily favored. I still have, my keys are over there, but I still have my 1990 World Series Reds keychain that I've had since
that's
then.
Amazing.
My sister lived in Cincinnati at the time, and she gifted me that when I was just a kid. You know, it's just 10 then. But yes, to answer your question, I think I'm heavier into it now because I think there's a time, you know, the Isbell line in Speed Trap Town, right?
Oh, 5A Bastards.
Yeah. It's a boy's last dream and a man's first loss.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's a period of time where you're like, it feels weird to love sports. At least it was for me. And then now that I'm in my middle age, I'm like, well, fuck it. I don't care that these 20-year-old kids are, you know, now it's like I'm at the point where it seems acceptable for me to be obsessed with the Reds again.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Love that. Love that journey for you.
Hell yeah. all right. So diving a little bit deeper back into Thin Places, natural segue,
absolutely.
Grief, loss, you were on the Records Revisited podcast. Shout out to my boys, and Ben and Wayne. And you talked about writing the titles before the songs, which is like a really interesting concept to me that I'm not sure I've heard a whole lot of. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Yeah, I don't know what evolved in my own life that made this process something that really works for me, but I think it's kind of... I think in terms of writing music, I very much like I get excited about the big moments and the big pictures, the big moments more than anything. And I feel like to really cultivate a big moment, you have to know where it is before you even start writing the rest of the song. Sorry, you don't have to, but it's the way that I like to do it. So I like to just like, I like to have a title, and then I'll usually like, I'll just give you an example here. I'll get like a little piece of paper like this, and I'll call the song like, let's call it Wrong About France.
Okay.
And then I'll just kind of go like, I'll just do something like that.
Oh shit. Okay. So for folks just listening, like there's a, he just sort of drew like, looks like a frequency.
Yeah. It's like a little squiggly line that just shows me my path. And like, here's a big moment right here. So like, I want it to look kind of like that big moment, but bigger. So I want this to foreshadow that moment. And then I just start drawing and going crazy. And I'm like, what does this look like? This is instability. Instability that happens before the big moment, it always makes the moment bigger.
Yes.
So then you got your little chorus, verses are the straight lines. And then you just, and then maybe I'll just do like a, maybe I'll just add like a star here, you know, at the beginning for like an intro. And then maybe I'll add like a, I don't know, like I want a big stop. So I just had an exclamation point at the end. And I think for me, this is like, I do this because I want to be like free once I start writing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to be thinking about like, oh no, am I going to get there the right way? Because I know where I'm going the whole time. So when I'm writing the verse, I'm thinking about the big moment. And when I'm writing the chorus, I'm thinking about the big moment. And then sometimes I'll write a song without a big moment. And I'll have, you know, different goals and stuff like that. And but I mean, that's typically how I operate. I tend to just think of songs in terms of their largest macro, like organizational units. And then once I do that, once I have a really like great blueprint, that's just like, you know, like a, that's just like, I've got my, my, what's it called when they got the scaffolding, I've got my scaffolding up, I've got I've got all my equipment. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to build this building. And I know it better than anyone does before they've even started building it. And so I can make every decision based on what the ultimate goal is, which is a big moment. So, I mean, a good example of this would be Jordan in the Nile. Mm-hmm. You know, I had that big moment that I just knew from the very beginning, I wanted that big fucking moment, and it had to happen and it had to be perfect. And so I took 4 years to write that song because I couldn't figure out how to make that stupid big moment work. But the original outline took about 2 minutes.
Wow. Okay. Is that a, so a couple of things. One, this gives me the excuse to say the adjective that I wanted to say.
Uh-huh.
It gives me permission now, which is so often in music journalism and commentary, we use the word lush. right? We describe things as lush, and oftentimes it there's no better way to say it, right? With your it is, but with your record, I was like, it's not, it's that, but it's not. And I was trying to figure out like what is the difference and how do I say this differently? And the word that came to mind that I kept like kind of sloughing off was thicket. And it almost makes a lot of sense now that you said all of that, because it's like it's dense, but also there's so much beauty there. And it's like I didn't quite want to say that because I didn't like the connotation of it being like too hard to get through, because that's not it at all with this. Yeah. You know, it's actually quite easy to get through. But it's almost like you're, you know, Br'er Rabbit in the Briar Patch as a listener. That's there it is. It's Br'er Rabbit in the Briar Patch is what I'm thinking of. And what you just described into your process sort of lends itself to that that feeling as a consumer of the music.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I tend to think of it in the same terms. Have you ever watched that Kobe Bryant documentary, Winning Time?
No.
Oh, it's so great. It's so great. He was a basketball genius. I mean, not just a great player, but he was a basketball genius and a problematic dude. But artistically, there are moments in that documentary that are just fascinating parallels to like writing. And I think one of the things that's apparent is his preparation, man. His preparation is so much. He doesn't have to think about Tony Parker and how Tony Parker likes to come right. He doesn't have to think about that. And that's a really simple example. He doesn't have to think about it because he knows it Tony Parker so instinctually at that point that his instincts have become Tony Parker's instincts. So I want my instincts to become my song's instincts. And I want to be able to just like kind of like flow into the state of creating. And I think the best way for me to do that is to have a really strong outline beforehand. And I know that's kind of like type A and a little bit, it's a little bit like, I don't know, maybe even just overly aggressive on the organization side, but that's just how I've always liked to do things. And I think it might have something to do with, you know, I studied classical music and we study a lot of form and analysis. And like a lot of times when you're doing analysis on these long pieces, that's what you're doing. You're writing these squiggly lines and like writing, here's the A section, here's the B section, here's a repeat, here's the development, here's the coda, whatever. And so I think just doing that over and over again, it made it like a really, really cool, for me, a really, really cool technique for like getting out what I wanted to get out and staying focused.
It's incredibly satisfying to me to hear you say that, because that's how I work.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I mean, I will jot down ideas and I will, you know, I have my sort of outline of what I want to talk to you about here. And that being said, we haven't talked about most of it and we probably won't, because it frees me up to then have the conversation I want to have with you, because I've already got in my head this sense of where we're going. And I'm still going to hit a few of those things, but it doesn't matter, because ultimately if the muse takes us some other direction, we're going to go some other direction, right?
Always got to leave room for the Holy Spirit. I wish I could take credit for that quote. That's Quincy Jones.
Oh, that's fucking great, man. Okay. So thinking about that classical background, and thinking about where you are now in the and then the structure that you like to, that helps you in your creative process. Are there times when you get bogged down at all by that diagramming kind of mind frame? Like you have that programming.
Yeah.
Is there any time where it sort of like puts handcuffs on you or in any way holds you back? Or is it freeing to know that like, I know this shit, but now I can kind of like have the freedom to go wherever I need to go?
Yeah, for me, it's like, I need to decide on one thing. Make one decision about what this song is. Just one, you know, and then just go from there. And again, you got to leave room for the muse or the Holy Spirit or whatever you want to say, because things are going to change, and they almost always do change, you know, and the big moment might change, but you'll have had a focus, you know, and I will have had a focus, so that like, when I do get to that point where I need to change something, I'm not like, you know, I mean, sometimes it feels, I think the thing that sometimes gets me in trouble, I guess, is that sometimes I will become too enamored with the big moment. And then I'll realize that this isn't the song at all. Actually, the song is the chorus. Like that's the song. And now I need to change things. And sometimes it takes me a little too long to change things up and decide that that's not going to be the big moment anymore, that the chorus is the big moment now, you know? Like, I can't remember my own song names, Floodgates or, when I was initially writing it, I had this really big, weird bridge, like a weird bridge. And then I got to the studio and we started recording it. And I was like, this isn't working very well. And it took me a week to finally be like, okay, I think we need to scrap this and start over. And so when we did, when we got rid of that section, I realized that like, oh, this is a country song with like a catchy chorus. Like, that's what this is. So like, I think one thing that is nice about this structure is like that thing that I drew, that squiggly line, like that doesn't mean anything to me yet. It's a very far off ideal that I haven't decided on its structural components yet. I haven't decided on its harmony, its melody, its chord structure, its tempo, its rhythm, its anything. I haven't decided on anything. I just know that I want to feel a certain way when I get to that point. You know, and so with that as my only kind of focus, I find that I'm able to, you know, bob and weave with writer's block as it comes.
Was that line or that title about Paris, about France, was that something that you had been like that had been ruminating, or is that something you just came up with?
It's been ruminating. I went to France recently and I was really scared to go to France because I'm a fat American, a fat, large American. Like I'm tall, I'm fat, and I'm in France, which is like notorious for like not liking Americans. So I thought I was going to hate it. And my wife really wanted to go. So we went, and then, you know, I just had the best time. I mean, I ate snails. Yeah. I really liked the people. I was like, it was not what I expected at all. And so I had this like line in my head. It's like, I was wrong about France, but right about you.
Oh my God. That's great.
Yeah.
Holy shit. That's great. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing where that, what those big moments are and where that goes.
Yeah. We'll see what happens with that one. And that's the other thing is like, I'm not this isn't the only way I do things. Like this is my baseline. This is like, if I wake up and I don't feel like writing a song, like I don't feel like just jumping into it, I fall back on my skills as a composer to be able to write something anyways, you know? And like, that's what this is for me. And like, sometimes inspiration strikes and I write a song in 10 minutes. That was Phantom Limb and Grandfather on the first record that I came out with. I mean, I wrote those songs in minutes, literally. And, you know, I think you have to leave room for that too, and leave room for your process to just be shit on by your next process.
Man, so many good nuggets there. And that's incredibly helpful. And I am envious of the fact that you have all that training and that ability and the work that you've already done. I wish I'd done that work too. But it's also, I'm also excited for you. And also just thinking about in general, trusting whatever level you're at in terms of your musical knowledge as a creator, you know, anybody listening or thinking about making things, like trusting whatever that level is and going back to the things that you know, right?
Yeah.
So like for me, it's words. And when I try, like melody is elusive to me. And so when I find it, but I just have to go back to words and have a sense that like, okay, there's a melody in there. It's there somewhere. I got to go back to the thing. And sometimes it comes to me, but most of the time it's me sitting down to write and express myself through the written word. And then the melody comes. But if I'm frustrated or stuck or struggling at all, and I go back to the words and I just go like, I know that my worst words are better than I think they are. And so just going back to that thing that I know I do well, and then trusting that will then free up so much more.
Yeah. It sounds like you are, it sounds like you might be afflicted with a condition that a lot of us have, including myself, which is that you have really killer taste. Your taste is awesome. And so when you're writing, you want your writing to measure up to your taste.
Yeah.
And it's like a constant battle of doing that. And then, you know, I think a lot of people go one of two ways. They hear, they feel this way. And then they're like, I don't feel like writing a shitty song. I'm going to go watch TV. And yeah. Like, that's me sometimes. And then there's another way you can go where it's just like, I'm just going to write the shitty song. I'm going to finish it. I'm going to actually like just write it all the way out. The chords, the lyrics. I don't care how much I hate it. I'm going to fucking finish this song. And I think those are the kind of things where like, I don't think that people wake up one day and just know how to write a song in 10 minutes. I think it happens as a result of like over and over again, following a process, you know. The best writers are the ones that get up every day and say, I hate what I'm writing, but I'm going to write anyways. You know, like Ernest Hemingway, 500 words a day, no matter what, guy had to write 500 words a day. And he hated 90% of what he wrote, you know, and I feel like I maybe do too. I mean, I've written a lot of songs, but I've only published 18 of them. Really. And so, I mean, yeah, at this point I'm like rambling, but this is one.
No, you're not. No, you're not rambling at all. I think this all is very helpful because, and I think, so here's a perfect anecdote, a quick one. I teach English and I have this one middle school English and I have this one class that's not really an English class. It's like, I have kids who are labeled gifted. Right. And so I can basically do whatever I want. And the directive is that I need to challenge them. I need to give them projects to work on, you know, get their brains going. So I'm doing this multimedia storytelling class. And what we're doing is I'm trying to give them as much freedom as possible with like slight structure. Cause you know, I don't want them to go off the rails and not do it, get anything done. But at the same time, and those kinds of brains, if you're not careful, sometimes those hyperactive brains will just like go off on some tangent and there's no product at the end, which I guess is fine. It's not, it's okay. It is. It is. But I, working similar to how you work, like needing that structure and craving that structure, I try to provide it for them. So anyway, I gave them a day where we sort of had basic parameters and I was like, do whatever you need to do. Just make something. Mm-hmm. And so I have a classroom guitar that I just pick up and every once in a while I'll strum. And like at the end of the day, it's a good stress reliever. So I was like, I'm going to do the same thing. So I grabbed the guitar and I just started strumming and I started like writing down some lines and I wrote down a couple of lines that I wrote basically like two verses. And when I first read them, I was like, this is doo-doo. Like this, there's nothing to this, which is fine. I've got a bunch of middle schoolers here that I'm trying to show process. It's fine. And then over the last month, dude, just it's evolved into something really beautiful.
Yeah. That's more times, more often than not, that can sometimes happen. And I think it's like, honestly, it's a cosmic reward for sticking with it. And I think that songwriting is definitely not always like this, but you know, sometimes it is. Sometimes you write something that you think is horrible. Like I have my next record. Is being produced by Bartiz Strange, and
dope.
Yeah, and he had I sent him the songs that I was thinking about, and some songs that I wasn't thinking about at all. But I was just like, well, I'll just send him everything because he likes to have he likes to have like a lot of stuff to sift through, and you know, he came back like with like three or four songs out of like the 30 that I sent him, my least favorites really. And was just like, I love these. These are awesome. And I was just had to like kind of remind myself again that like, you're not your best judge. You're just never going to be your best judge. Mm-hmm. You're going to be your harshest judge. You're going to be your most hateful judge, your most critical judge. But you know, I mean, you're not going to be the most accurate. And I think that's why it's important to play music for people and to like, mm-hmm. and you did that, you know, with your students and just kind of let other people be involved in the process. Because I think like none of us are islands. We're not designed to operate in that way. And I feel like a lot of times when we do, that's where you get a lot of pretentious music because people are just so up in their heads and they're trying to account for all their deficiencies and all their self-consciousness. And what ends up happening is they create this sort of high and mighty caricature of themselves. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't know. I can't remember where I was going with that, but anyways.
Well, I want to comment on a couple of things there that I love. And that is, you know, I've been thinking a lot about community, and I've been thinking a lot about loneliness as I go through this transition in my life. And one of the things that has come abundantly clear to me is how grateful I am to have the support system that I have, and how incredible it is to have people around me, and how easy it is once you have a certain settled life in a way, right? You sort of know where your career is headed. You're at a certain age where you go, these are my habits, and maybe I need to tweak some of them, and I need to work on some of them, but I'm not stagnant, but I'm also like understanding of who I am, and how there is, if you're not careful, if you're not making the effort to reach out to people to help sharpen you, and that you sharpen them, that there is a loneliness that can set in that's really dangerous. And I think there's what you just hit on is something that I struggle with, which is a creative loneliness, because I'm so reluctant to share things before I think they're completely done.
Yeah.
And there's a creative loneliness to that that isn't necessarily healthy. For me, at least, I need to get those things out there. I played an open mic for the first time in 3 years the other day, dude. And everybody loved it, and it was so wonderful, and I felt so great, and I got that high again, and I can't wait to get back and do it again, you know? But I hadn't played it in 3 years, strictly because of my own, in my head, creative loneliness, had only been creating on my own, pandemic hit, blah, 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 right? And then finally, I got out there and played, and I was like, what the fuck have you been doing for the last 3 years, buddy?
Yeah,
like,
man.
This is so enjoyable. Get out there, share this stuff. And Guy Clark, to paraphrase, said, like, you don't know if that song's done until you play it for somebody.
Exactly.
Right? There's the only way you know.
Yeah, a song that you haven't played for someone is just a decontextualized floating ball of air. You know, it's just like, it's not doing anything. It's literally doing nothing. And it's actually doing worse for you, because it's like being pregnant for 15 months. Well, that's a terrible thing to say for women that are actually pregnant. But like, you know, I don't know, like, pregnant with an idea, like a longing, like a sort of like you're so excited to meet this kid, you know, but then you don't let him be born, or you don't, and you make him stay there, and like it just gets bigger and bigger, and you get heavier and heavier, and you can't like even walk around anymore because you're just depressed about the fact that like you spent so much time nurturing this thing, and then it just dies eventually.
And in the meantime, it's just like eating, it's like taking from you too, right? Because you're not, letting it out.
I think that there is never a situation in which you won't be vulnerable when you play a song to someone.
Oh, wow. There's you still never, feel that way?
Absolutely. Like, I mean, I think that I've sort of, you know, made like this macro adjustment in my life where I sort of can compartmentalize that vulnerability. But you bet, man, if somebody came up to me afterwards after a set that I thought I killed and just said that they, you know, hated this one song or something like that, you bet your ass I will lose sleep that night. You know, it's not like I'm not vulnerable. I think I'm very confident in my abilities and my ability to write and my ability to kind of share this music with people. But at the same time, it's like, I think I'm just comfortable being vulnerable now. I think that's what it is. It's just like, if you can find a state of comfort in vulnerability, that's a level of life that, you know, everyone should aspire to.
Oh, that's great, man. The free Zoom is about to run out. Can we end this and click the same link?
Yep.
And run it back just for a few more minutes, because I still have stuff I want to talk to you about. And this is fucking beautiful, man. Thank you so much. Let's do it.
Yeah, sure.
All right, cool.
Yo.
Dude. Maybe the fastest recovery time of any guest ever on the Marinade podcast, free Zoom.
I'm an engineer. I know my way around a computer.
Man, I wish everyone that I interview had quite such skills. No, I love you guys. All of you listening. Some of you do listen. You're wonderful. Okay. I have a couple of things that I want to ask you about, and this has been such a delight. I would be remiss if I did not. You mentioned going to France, and was that the same trip that you were in Italy?
Yep.
Okay. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the moment that I've seen on the internet with you singing opera. Can you just take us through that moment? So beautiful.
I was just sitting at a table with, I was at a company meetup, you know, cause my day job is software engineer. I don't make enough money doing music, not even close to enough money to support my family. So mm-hmm. I have a day job and, they're an all remote company, so they don't have like a building or anything. So they can like spend all the overhead that they would spend on a building on like a big trip every year that we can all go to and just hang out because we never see each other otherwise. And so like, it's always a good time. We're always having, you know, it's always fun to like meet up with everybody and the wine is flowing and, you know, it's the company's paying for these cool dinners and stuff like that. First time in my life I've ever been a part of something like this, because up until 2 years ago, I was a musician only. So like, it's been a whole new world for me. But anyways, that's the context. We were at the last like farewell dinner or whatever. And there was an Italian trio there, accordion, guitar, and bass. And they were just singing traditional Italian songs and some opera. And I love Puccini. And I was like, do you guys know La Donna Immobile? And they were like, yeah, yeah. And they're all these like real charismatic, real like intense Italian guys. They're like, when people are walking into the restaurant, you know, we're all getting off a bus and we're walking into the restaurant, they're like literally getting right in people's faces and just like singing to them. And like, it's just, you know, it's glorious. And they're incredible musicians and great feel and just a pleasure to listen to. But anyways, so they're just going around the tables at this point. We're kind of finishing up dinner. We've all got a few glasses of wine in us, and they come over, and I was like, do you guys know La Donna Immobile? And with no intention of getting up and like grabbing a mic and singing, I truly did not. This was not, it might be surprising, but it's not my style to do that. But the guy was just insistent, and I hadn't sang anything. He didn't know me. He didn't know I could sing or anything, or that I studied opera in college. And so he asked me to come up and sing it with them. And I was like, no, you guys sing it. Cause I don't even remember the words that well. But I did know the words to one part, and I was just like, you know what, man, like what you were talking about earlier, like not sharing it with folks, is like, if you've got a light, just let it shine. Cause it just like, it gives people something that is just like, it's ineffable. It's really hard to describe. But anyways, so I was just like, fuck it, I'm gonna blow these people's minds. And so I got up and I sang the loudest and most intense opera vibrato that I, you know, that as I possibly could. And there was one part that I knew really well. I knew the words really well, and I knew I could sing it. And I chose that part, and I was just like, okay, I'm going for it right here. And I just went for it. And then all of a sudden, these men just start kissing me. They just start kissing my cheeks and stuff. Like, I'm still holding out the note, and they like grab my head and start kissing my cheeks, and like they're, you know, just being super cool about everything, and you know, watching my direction as I'm like kind of conducting them for like how long am I going to hold this and stuff. And it was just a really organic moment. And then of course, like everybody was just so like, a spontaneous performance is just an exciting thing to witness.
Yes.
For people in general. And I think, yeah, I just didn't want to deprive people of that.
It's amazing, dude. What was the vibe like in that space? Like how were people? It's hard to tell from a video, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it was loud. They were losing their minds. yeah, it was cool. I mean, I don't think anybody expected me to get up and do that. People know I'm a musician at this company. People know that I like tour and work. And so they know like I can do this. I don't think any of them knew that I could sing tenor like that.
Yeah.
Man, and by the way, that shit is so hard, and I can only do it for like 30 seconds. Like that kind of singing takes like your entire body to do well. And I have like massive respect for guys on stage, women and men on stage that just like do this unbelievably demanding physical singing while also acting out a part. It's in it, over like a period of like 4 hours. I'm just like, I don't know how you guys do that. That's amazing. But
it
yeah.
is amazing. It gives me, and this is probably, this is just a lot of this is ego and control issues that my therapist would say, but it gives me anxiety when people are that good at that kind of thing. I mean, believe me, it moves me in other ways too. But when I see someone that good at something that difficult, it's like when I watch a really great film in a theater. Same thing for a really great live theater, whatever we're talking about, that's just incredibly well done. Yes, I feel all of the things I'm supposed to feel, but it also gives me a great deal of anxiety and like,
yeah.
It like hits me.
I kind of know what you mean. Is it like an uncertainty about your own place in the world?
It's a mortality thing. Yeah, I get that.
I totally get that. I think I feel like that sometimes when I hear certain guitar players where I'm just like, fuck, that's so good. Sorry, can I say fuck on here?
You can say fuck all you want. It's
okay,
fucking...
well, fuck, man. Yeah.
Fuck.
That's sometimes when I'm hearing a guitarist, it doesn't happen so much when I hear a singer, but when I hear a guitarist that's like really good, I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? My life, like I feel like I'm like definitely above average in terms of my guitar playing, but like every now and then I'll see somebody that's just like, oh whoa, I'm not close, I'm not in the same universe as this person, and then I will get that kind of sort of like weird self-conscious sort of anxiety going on.
Yeah, well, that's a great segue into what we usually end on, which is what you're getting down on. So is there maybe it's the art that has you inspired at the moment. Is there a guitar performance you've seen lately, a record you've been listening to, a book you're reading? Like, what kind of things have you fired up right now?
Oh, man, so many things. As far as books go, I've recently read, I do this like every few years where I'll read Brave New World and then read this book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. So I read those two books recently. Musically, I've been listening to the new John Moreland record all day today, and whoa, what a fucking songwriter, dude. Like it's there's so much gravitas.
Yeah,
you know. Shit,
yeah,
I don't know.
Dude, that line about throwing punches at the moon.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty great.
I've only gotten to listen to it twice because I teach, so I worked all day. And
yeah.
So I can't exactly listen to John Moreland while I'm teaching middle school English.
No.
He will throw a fuck in there when you don't expect it. And it's great and it lands, but not exactly something I can listen to with my seventh graders
I think that's what he does best is lands.
Yeah.
Like I like that word you use. Like all of his lyrics, like they all land really well. Like one of my biggest pet peeves when I hear songs is like, and there's a certain bit of like allowance I have here, like, you know, if you need to kind of fit a word in a weird way, okay, whatever. But if you like fit like multiple words in a row in like a really weird rhythm in a way that nobody ever says them with like weird emphasis and stuff, I'm just like, okay, just maybe woodshed that one a little bit more. But John Moreland is always landing, man. He's always landing.
He does. I was talking with my friend Jordan Foley earlier today, and Jordan's a wonderful songwriter, and we were just texting back and forth about the record while I was still trying to do my job. And he was like, we were just gushing about it. And then I listened to it on the way home, and I ride my bike home. So it was really nice. Like the weather here is incredible right now. And I'm riding my bike home and I'm listening to the Moreland record again. And I'm thinking he will have a whole stretch where he just very plainly and simply says things, even the rhyme, he's just rhyming things that are kind of intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
And then that line punches you in the fucking nose or shit.
Yeah.
Like he sets you up so beautifully, and it's all in the context of incredibly heavy themes and stories. But for a while there, he kind of lulls you to sleep for a second sometimes.
For sure. And then he hits you with the big line. You know what he reminds me of, the way that he writes in that way? He kind of reminds me of the poet Mary Oliver. She has these poems where it'll be, you know, every line is packed and every line is great, but there's always one line at the end that's just like, oh shit, I'm gonna cry now. And I feel like that's kind of John Moreland has a similar thing going on there. But other than that, I've been listening to this pop band from the UK who came out with a song called Call Me Up today. And it's just like a pop, like kind of, funky disco-y sounding song that just came out today. And I've listened to it like 40 times just because I think it's so catchy. I'm a sucker for like a catchy song, even if the lyrics are dog shit. I won't admit that I like it if the lyrics are dog shit, but I definitely listen to it a lot. Like I listen to, okay, this is a perfect example. I don't know if I want to admit this publicly, but I listened to this song, this Sam Hunt song. What was it called? He has like a Webb Pierce sample at the beginning of it. And it's there stands the ground. I gotta use all my pain. What is this freaking song called? Oh no, I'm not gonna be able to remember it. But I mean, it's Sam Hunt. Like, come on. It's not a great song, but damn, I've wanted to listen to it. Just like I listened to it like 60 times. I think he
Yeah.
covered it one time. I got to a show and I was just like, I'm gonna cover this right now.
How did that go? How did that go over?
Fine. I mean, everybody was laughing because I was covering Sam Hunt, but I mean,
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, so every now and then I'll run into a song that like it doesn't matter if it's lame. If it's a catchy chorus and I'm just vibing to it, I'll listen to it, 40, 50. And I definitely like I'm a repeat listener. So I'm less of an albums guy. I just don't think there's a lot of great albums these days, to be honest. I think people have kind of lost that skill. And I think that so for me, a lot of times it's a song. Like I'll hear a song and I'll listen to that song in one day, maybe like 60, 70, 80 times just in a row on loop. And but anyways, rambling again. Sorry about that. That's
No,
what's
it's great.
inspiring me right now.
Man, that's awesome. And so I said that was what we end on, but I also, like, as you were talking about that, it made me think about Bartice Strange a little bit. And like I'm wondering how much you can tell us about that process and that record that you're making with Bartiz.
Why don't we just do it on the next episode?
That sounds great. All
Yeah.
right, deal. Fuck yeah. Dude, this has been such a pleasure. I'm so glad we connected,
Absolutely. Sorry, it took me like eight tries to finally get on here.
buddy. It happens. You're a busy man, and I'm just incredibly grateful for your interest and your time. And you just gave me more than I possibly could have asked for. So thank you
Awesome,
so
man. That's
much,
great.
dude.
I love
Yeah.
to hear that.
Awesome.
Cool, man. Well, good luck to you. Let me know when the podcast comes out.
Yep, I'll keep you posted. I'm backed up right now because I've been moving, but now that I'm getting settled in, I'm gonna start cranking them out. I got some cool stuff. I got to catch up with Colby T. Helms at Swanee, and like that young man's great, and he's such a sweetheart. And then I've got a whole bunch of stuff in the can right now that I can't wait to get out. But I'm probably on like a 1 week once a week clip right now, so I'm really excited
Nice.
for folks to hear this, and I'll keep you posted.
Cool, man. Sounds great.
All right, dude. Have a great night.
You too, man. We'll talk to you later.
All right, later.
Bye.
Jason Hawk Harris, y'all. Thank you so much, Jason. Thank all of you for listening. JasonHawkHarris.com for all things Jason Hawk Harris. I've wanted to do this for a long time. I've been a fan of his for several years, and this was a huge honor. And I'm just really grateful that we stuck with the scheduling. Life kept throwing us curveballs. It happens sometimes. And we stuck with it, and I'm really proud of this conversation. The song you're hearing in this episode is Jordan in the Nile from Jason's outstanding record, Thin Places. MarinadePodcast.com for all things The Marinade. Follow us on all the socials. Subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on your podcast app. Tell a friend about the show. These are all free ways to support The Marinade. Go do that right now while you're listening, please. It makes a big difference for us and costs so little of your time and effort. If you really like what we're doing, please consider joining our Patreon community, y'all, for just $2 a month. You can gain access to Patreon exclusive content like our show, Jason's Journey, where I talk about the moments that shape my creative life and provide a window into the process of making The Marinade. One of the best months, best days, pardon me, of the month is recording What We're Getting Down On. That is the show with my good friend, the dear, brilliant Peter Haraldson, where we talk about the art that has us fired up at the moment. It's so much fun, and folks really seem to be enjoying listening to it for over a year now. We've been doing it for a year and almost a half. Y'all, you can try a free trial of Patreon, see if you like it. No pressure. Try it for 7 days. Set a reminder on your phone in case you want to cancel, and keep going if you dig it. If you want to support the show financially, but you don't want to commit to a monthly subscription, I totally get that. You can Venmo or PayPal us. It's just at the Marinade, and all the money goes right back into making the show. We're going to cover a couple of festivals. We haven't fully locked down our schedule this summer, but I'm working hard on doing quite a bit of podcast work this summer. If you listen to this show regularly, you know that I am a middle school teacher, so I have 2 months off coming up. Blackwater Soul Review looks like it's a go in St. Augustine. Alicia Pollock is going to be there taking photographs, and it looks like I'm going to be doing a little coverage of my own with her. So I'm excited about that. We've got, hopefully we're heading to Laurel Cove up in the Cumberland Gap. Just some really cool stuff that's happening, trying to get to Bonnaroo again this year. So if you can swing it, every little bit helps, and we really appreciate it. But above all, we're just so grateful you listen and spread the word about the Marinade. And until next time, go out and create something. Cheers, y'all.